You are listening to End of Life University Podcast, Real Talk About Life and Death. This is episode number 153. Welcome to End of Life University Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, hospice physician, author, and educator. In this podcast, I share thoughtful conversations with experts in various fields related to dying and death, and informative teaching sessions on preparing for the end of life by living fully today. And I want to thank you so much for joining me here for another episode of the podcast. Today, I'm going to be sharing with you an interview with Michelle Petticolis, who is a filmmaker and also a grief counselor. And we're going to talk first briefly about the three films that she has made, The Secrets of Life and Death. And then we're going to get into grief counseling and some unique issues that Michelle sees around grief and how she treats grief holistically in her practice. So we'll get to that interview in just a few moments. But before we get started, just a couple of announcements. First of all, I want to thank my latest supporters on Patreon, Christina Ensminger and Jackie Yeager. Thank you so much for stepping up and making a monthly contribution to this podcast and also the End of Life University interview series. I so appreciate your help. It means everything to me and serves as a reminder to me that people do appreciate the work that I'm doing. So it makes all the difference to me. If you would like to become a supporter as well, and you'll receive special bonuses when you do, you can go to Patreon, spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N, patreon.com/EOLU, and sign up to make a monthly contribution of as little as a dollar per month and take advantage of some of the special bonuses that are available to you there. So thanks again for all of my supporters who've been stepping up for the last couple of years and helping me out with this podcast and the interview series. I wanted to mention last week I held a webinar with Suzanne O'Brien on end-of-life doula training for caregivers and volunteers. It was really fantastic and very well received, and I just wanted to mention that if you missed it, you can still catch a replay of that webinar. If you go to eoluniversity.com/O'Brien, O-B-R-I-E-N, you'll find a page there. You can just sign up and that will take you directly to the link for watching the replay. There will be slides plus audio that you can hear from our conversation, and it was really fantastic. Suzanne is amazing. So if you missed it, I encourage you to go back and take a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. Even if you're not interested yourself in being a death doula, the training that Suzanne offers is so important for anyone and everyone. We should all have certain knowledge about death and dying and how to help someone in our own lives who's dying. So this is the very, very most basic training that anyone should have in order to be there for a loved one, a friend, a neighbor who's dying. So again, go to eoluniversity.com/O'Brien, O-B-R-I-E-N, and there will be a link to that page in the show notes. So without further ado, we'll get on with today's interview with Michelle Petticolis. And in the interview, we talk about her film series, which at the time we spoke was not yet available for the public, but it is now. And so you can go to her website, which is, let me find it here so I don't tell you the wrong thing, secretsoflifeanddeath.com. And you can find out more about how to obtain the film series if you'd be interested in showing it in your community. Maybe, as I'm always encouraging people, have a have a film series in your community with a discussion group after each film. So her films are each around 30 minutes long, which is ideal to get a conversation started, and have people stay for another 45 minutes or an hour after the film and have a discussion. So again, you can go to secretsoflifeanddeath.com. That is Michelle's website. And you'll be able to find out how you can obtain the films. And like I said, in the interview, we mentioned that she hasn't yet released them, but she actually now has. So I just wanted to clarify that for you. Stay tuned after the interview, and I'll come back to say goodbye and also to share with you my takeaways from the interview with Michelle. So here we go. I hope you enjoy this conversation. My guest today is Michelle Petacolis of Secrets of Life and Death, and I'll be doing a little bio for her so you can get to know her a little bit better. Dr. Petacolis has been working in the field of death and loss for over 17 years. She has a PhD in sociology with a minor in clinical psychology. She produced the award-winning three-part documentary series, Secrets of Life and Death, featuring consciousness leader Ram Dass and Zen Hospice founder Frank Ostasevsky, who also appeared in Bill Moyer's four-part PBS series, On Our Own Terms. Michelle has been invited to speak and teach in hospitals, hospices, and professional organizations throughout Northern California, including UCSF, John Muir, and JFK University. She has appeared on Voice America's Good Grief, Comcast Newsmakers, and KPFA's Women's Magazine. And you can read more about Michelle's work at the website secretsoflifeanddeath.com. So, Michelle, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you, Karen, for inviting me. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I've been excited to just talk to you about all of the work that you've been doing over the years. But I was hoping you'd start out by just telling us a little bit more about your story and what got you interested in learning more about death and grief and the end of life.
Well, it's an interesting thing. I never thought I would have any interest in death until my parents died. And they died 6 months apart in the year 1998. And there was nothing in my life and in my experience that prepared me for that event of losing both of them. I was just knocked off my feet, could not believe the immensity of the grief that I felt, was totally enraged that I was not prepared, made tons of mistakes, and had such remorse. And then there were these terrible arguments afterwards with my family members, and that was confusing too. It's like we had lost the sun of our solar system, and all of us had just flown out in every different direction, and we literally had to create new relationships after the loss of our mother. And first, I was just really overwhelmed by it, but at the time, I was doing a TV show over in San Francisco. It was live a part of the time and pre-recorded the other time. And I decided that I was curious about why I was being so impacted. And I invited some people from a grief group to appear on my show. And it was fascinating. I mean, I got all kinds of interesting responses from some very, very interesting people. One who had gone through, I guess it was lymphoma and had survived and what he had done to survive, to somebody who had this uncanny experience where after her father died, her mother receives a delivery of flowers that are her favorite flowers and no card. And,
wow.
And no record of who had sent them, you know, just like within a half hour after her husband died.
Wow.
And so it was like there were these goosebumps around this. And I talked to a number of people who told me these really amazing things. And I got inspired. And I thought, well, this isn't enough. I want to do more. I want to make a film. And I had never made a documentary film, so this was totally by the seat of my pants. I had no idea. I didn't even have a camera. And I just kept on finding ways of doing it and just feeling this compelling desire to make a film, to understand. First of all, or the first reason was that I didn't want people to make mistakes like I did. And, you know, this was back before Bill Moyers had made his film series On Our Own Terms.
Yes.
So nobody was making films.
Yeah.
Of course, he got his done finished for sooner than I did. But, oh, well, you know, it was quite a journey. And I met a lot of interesting people. It gave me the permission to ask a lot of important questions. And then I started putting the film together, and it turned out that it was really three films. And a number of people really advised me to break it into three films. Otherwise, I would have to change it. So, I mean, actually, I took it to, I had, in the process of making the film, I had joined hospice. And at that time, when I was trying to edit the films together, I was leading a grief group over at Sutter Hospice. And I showed the films, the pieces, and they said, keep them separate. Keep them three different films. And I said, oh, okay. And so I made three films. There are three half-hour films, and this turned out to be perfect because when I would screen the films, I would invite people into dialogue around what came up for them around the films. And part of the responsibility of making a film is to get it out there in the world. It's like you think, oh, I've got the film, and now everybody will just, you know, run up and take care of it from there on. No, you have to distribute it. You have to get it out there in the world. You have to promote it. And that's what I did. And, you know, just bit by bit, I started doing a lot of screenings. And in 2010, I got a grant from the Lloyd Symington Foundation to bring these films and my work to the cancer community. And so I sent out copies of my films to cancer organizations all over the United States and invited them and required them actually to do film screenings for their community. So that's basically how it evolved and morphed. And so then, as I said, you had asked, well, how did I get into, you know, becoming a grief coach? Well, at hospice, I started leading a grief support group, because that's where I found that's where I was drawn, was helping people to navigate that rocky terrain and come out the other side and discover what life was going to be afterwards. And I found that after initially starting in it and being totally overwhelmed by everybody's grief story, that I didn't have to go there, that I could allow them to have their grief and not take it on, because I wasn't doing any good taking it on. So that became my mission, was to help people. And I felt like I was a new life midwife, that I was helping people to use that or, you know, transition into what their next life was. Hmm. So I hope, yeah.
I was going to say, I hear a couple of messages in there. One was, you know, the anger that you felt in a way of being so unprepared for how it felt when your parents died, which I think is a product of our society, because I see it happening all around me. You know, when we live in a society where no one talks about death, none of us can actually be prepared ahead of time for what that experience will be like when we lose the people that we love. And I think your experience in that moment was still what's happening, in spite of the efforts of so many of us trying to put messages out there to get people to talk more about death and dying. We still have a long way to go to make progress.
I think that's one of the values of the films, are that these people are so courageous in sharing their stories. And so after you see that they have shared their stories, it invites the people, the audience, to share their stories as well. That's what's so dynamic about the films. There's a way in which you're really drawn in to the experience. They're beautiful films.
Mm-hmm. And at least what I've observed is that when people have some inkling of what the dying process is about, or have at least given some thought or had a discussion with someone about death and dying in advance, it makes the journey of a loved one's death a little bit easier to go through, because it's not something just brand new that has never even been contemplated before. And I don't know if that's in your mind, it would have been helpful for you if you had had just any of that information or knowledge before your parents died.
Of course it would have been helpful. And when I decided to make the film, what came to me was, nobody's going to go out and read a book on death, although now they do. But back then, nobody was reading books on death until it was like right smack in their face. But they might go and see a film, because there's, it's sort of like a less of a commitment to just go and see a half-hour film as opposed to, plow through a whole book. I remember after my father was diagnosed with Alzheimer's that my sister gave me a book on Alzheimer's to read. And I got, through maybe the first chapter, and then it was like, oh, I can't read this. It's just too upsetting. I'm living this. I can't read it, too. Mm-hmm. So that was the thought. But you're absolutely right that we do need to be talking about this. And there are a number of wonderful initiatives out there. Certainly the death cafes is a great way of engaging in dialogue. And then there's the Let's Talk About Death with Dinner initiative. And so there is more discussion. And certainly you're finding that in the film industry, the subject of death is coming up a lot more, and they're trying to be more realistic instead of the glorified Hollywood notion of, the person in their nice little bed and everybody congregating around, and then they take a nice, sweet last exhale and they die. It's all, everybody is so happy, but it doesn't happen that way.
Well, one of the things I've been promoting here in this interview series is encouraging people in their own communities to use film as a way to encourage conversations in their community, to host a film screening or invite a filmmaker to come and bring their film, because I think it is a great way to open people up and to, as you described, to get people to start talking because they've seen others on the screen who are talking about what they're experiencing. And so I was excited to just let everyone in the audience know about your three films, because I understand that they will be, in the future, they will be available for that
home
type
use.
Of use. Yeah, for home use.
Yes. So up until this point, I have been concentrating on the academic market. Of course, trying to recoup all the production costs. And I am now, that's pretty much over. And I want to go ahead and enable people, if they want to purchase the films. And I'm also going to be looking into setting up a way for people to access them through online streaming. So I'm going to look at both those avenues so that people can have these films. And I think what really sets my films apart from a lot of the films that are out there around death and dying is that they are not preachy. They are not there to give you a course or education in that, okay, now this talking head, this expert comes up and tells you how you should, do an advanced directive. It's not like that. It's the real people going through these experiences and sharing with you what they were thinking and feeling during that time or in that time. And so you're allowed to go and experience those experiences with them, and then this opens your heart and opens you up to, oh, okay, what would I do under those circumstances? How can I be prepared? How can I do this better?
And I love that, rather than having an expert who's spewing out facts and has a PowerPoint presentation that you have to take notes on, it's just, this is so much more heart-centered and so much more evocative and helps people open themselves and really respond with their emotions and their whole being to the subject of death.
Yes, well, that is the intention. They were initially designed to create dialogue, and that's what they do.
Mm-hmm. Could we mention the titles of just the three films, just so that people will have those in mind?
Sure. So the whole series is called Secrets of Life and Death. That was going to originally be the name of the one film that I planned on making until it morphed into three. So Secrets of Life and Death, and that's also my website, secretsoflifeanddeath.com. And the first one is called Facing Death with Open Eyes, which is how do we face, it's about how do we face death consciously instead of just putting it off until it sort of just mugs us and takes us away. You know, it's like, how do we just look at it and be curious and say, wow, what's that like? I had a friend who was dying and they had drugged her up pretty good because she was in a lot of pain. And she was trying to answer a question and she would stop a minute and she'd say, oh, that's what that's like. And there was a sense of curiosity in her in those steps along the way. Oh, that's what that's like. So that's what I invite people to do, is to be curious. Then the next film is called Caring for Dying, Caring for Dying, The Art of Being Present. And because I felt like I had been such a terrible or inadequate caregiver myself, I was curious about how people could make it a really wonderful experience. And I interviewed people who told me some amazing things, but what it really amounted to was not getting it perfect, not doing everything right, but being honest and open-hearted. And so that is just a really, really beautiful film. And then the last one is about grief, and it's called The Heart of Grieving. And it gives the experience of that arc from realizing somebody is going to die to their dying to the aftermath. And there are some just exquisite moments in there, like this young man whose mother, he's watched his mother die. And he says, you know, it was this strange moment because she was there and now she's gone, but her body's still there. It's just not breathing. It's like, and where did she go? I mean, she's here. Where? It was just a lovely goosebumps moment. He talks about that.
And there was something I picked up from the trailer. A woman was talking about when she went to pick up her husband's ashes from the crematorium. They were in a box that was stamped temporary container. And I thought, wow, that sums up in a way our whole orientation to life on Earth. We're here in a temporary container. And once we know that, then make the most of this temporary container, but know that you will have to leave it aside at some point.
There's a book by a woman named Ganga Stone, and I'm blanking on the name of the book, but you could probably Google her and death and find out. And she says, we go through life thinking that we're going to continue to live forever. And the fact of the matter is that we have a lease on the body that we have. And that in, not the fine print, although we may think it's fine print, it says this lease can be revoked at any time without forewarning.
Exactly. And that is in some ways, it's the most basic fact of our existence, and yet it's so ignored and undiscussed in the general population.
Yes. It's just interesting. I think you get a hit of it if you've ever been in a close brush with, you know, spinning out of control in your car and somehow miraculously nobody hits you, that how close that life and death is, that in a moment you could be gone. Mm-hmm. And it happens to people all the time.
Yes, exactly. Well, I wanted to I wanted people to be aware of your films because I think it would be there's something that could and should be shown in communities, but also hospices. It sounds like to me could use them. I'm sure they have already in the past shown these films. I'd love for people to be aware of them, and then they can stay in contact with you, Michelle, to find out when they are available.
When they're available, yes. I have to do the groundwork on setting that up, and this is like the third time that I've gotten this nudge. So the third time is a charm. Okay, we've got to get them out.
I wanted to move on a little bit, Michelle, to talk about your work with grief, since now you do a lot of coaching and consulting with people who are grieving. So I want to learn what you have learned from that experience. And just share with us what some of your thoughts are on why people have so much trouble dealing with grief.
Well, the primary reason why people have trouble dealing with grief is that everything that they're taught about dealing with grief is wrong. For the most part, in our culture, we're taught to tamp down our feelings and to move on, to not let it disrupt our lives. The average amount of leave time that you get in the work world is 3 days, which is it's ludicrous. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in the past when they used to have this idea of at least a year of mourning where you had to wear black clothes was much more on the mark than 3 days.
Yes.
But we don't want to lose our productivity. So that's the number one reason, is that we're taught the wrong things. We're taught to distract ourselves. We're taught to run away. We're taught to ignore. We're taught to compartmentalize. But here's the problem. The thing is that when we lose somebody really significant in our lives, it actually impacts our bodies. It triggers an emotional, energetic response that comes with a whole cascade of chemicals in your body that leave you feeling anxious, upset, despairing, hopeless. And if you don't address grief in the right way, you can actually re-stimulate the cascade of those chemicals over and over and over again. And you can actually make yourself sick.
Mm-hmm.
The Harvard School of Public Health did a study on people who had experienced a significant loss. And they found that people who had were 21 times more likely to experience a heart attack than people who had not experienced a significant loss. What's more, this relationship held true even for people who were not at risk. That's a huge number, 21 times more likely.
Yes. Yeah, that's incredible. It's literally the broken heart.
It's literally the broken heart. And so there is a physiological response. There's a physiological reaction to grief and loss. And it's very disorganizing to the brain, because the brain, I don't know if you've read anything about the neuroplasticity of the brain and all the neural nets that run around in the brain, is that you develop these deeply entrenched neural networks around the person that's your significant other. The more significant, the more you see them, the more those pathways are made. And then suddenly that person is gone, and you know, you go, your brain's happily going down this pathway and hits this dead end. It hits this void, this drop off. It's hard. It takes time for the brain to rewire, to think about things in a different way, to get used to it, to say, okay, now what? Now how do we make sense of the universe? It's like the brain can go offline. A lot of people have a hard time thinking during the first few months. It's just exhausting. And it is exhausting because it takes time for that body to heal.
And you know, as you're saying, our society is really unaware of this impact of grief on the body, but so is the medical profession. And so people who might go to a doctor with various symptoms, which really are related to grief, may get the wrong treatments. I mean, they may get pushed in the wrong direction, from what I've observed in the past, because doctors don't even know to ask about grief or to address it or how to help someone with it.
Well, typically they treat it as depression.
Mm-hmm.
And so they give you drugs that will mute the symptoms of grief. But anybody who has worked with the human body on multiple issues, a holistic approach is what's required, that you don't want to suppress symptoms. The symptoms are there. The body is giving us messages because the body is saying, you need to do something. When you mute that, you're turning off the warning system here. And so then if that doesn't work, then there are other avenues that the body will take to try and wake you up. One of those is illness.
Yes, and even physical or mental or emotional illness. And yet again, the underlying grief so often is unrecognized and not addressed when someone with those symptoms goes in for help and tries to get help for it.
Well, here's the thing. Grief does not go away. You know, some you've heard the phrase, time heals all wounds. Well, that's bogus. It's not true. It's like if you break your arm and you just wait for it to heal, it's not going to heal. You actually have to do exercises in order to gain capacity back. And you know what? If you don't do those exercises, you do not get the capacity back. The arm becomes, the shoulder, whatever, becomes frozen. I know, I actually broke my shoulder. And it's not fun to do those exercises, and you have to do them. Mm-hmm. And so in the same way, grief is like that. You have a broken heart. You have to take action to start to change that. Now, oftentimes, the first few months is not the time to take a lot of action because the whole system is in shock. So I work with people who are more like 3 to 6 months out from a loss as opposed to right away. But it depends upon the person, and it depends upon the nature of the loss. So I can work with people right away, too, depending on how they're dealing with it. When people don't deal with their loss, it doesn't go away. It just gets, you know, if they compartmentalize it, tamp it down, it's there. And what I find is that when a new loss happens, all the old losses jump to the surface, too. Like mm-hmm. by association, they all show up.
Mm-hmm. I think that's so true. And I think what you're saying is one of the myths in our society is that, oh, grief will just go away on its own if you allow it enough time. So you can ignore it for a year or so, and then it will go away. And one day you won't feel it anymore, which is absolutely false.
Well, it is true in the sense that if we develop the muscular armor and the emotional armor around our bodies, we won't feel it. But we won't feel anything else either. Mm-hmm. That's the problem, is that in order to hold those emotions at bay, we put on this coat of armor. And in men, sometimes it's over muscular, and with women, it might be additional fat. But we literally create desensitized tissue on our body to help us not feel. And those people who have spent their whole life doing that, they may not notice this. It's having an impact on their bodies. But they may not feel it because they aren't feeling anything. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Yes, yes. Yeah, definitely. So tell us a little bit about how you work with a client, and what are some of the suggestions that you might have for someone who's grieving?
Well, the very first and foremost area that we work on is allowing the feelings. And it's interesting and stunning how many people do not know how to listen to their bodies, how to really allow feelings, how to feel their feelings. And so that becomes the practice, is how do you learn to listen into your body and allow the feelings to just emerge without fanning the flames. Most of us, when we start to feel feelings, a whole bunch of thoughts jump in. And those thoughts could tamp it down, which is not allowing the feelings, or they could inflame the feelings. And so you can get in this loop where you feel bad and then you have thoughts about, oh, my God, it's always going to be like this. I'm never going to get any better. I miss the person so much. And then the emotions happen more, and you kind of get in this cycle and you say, oh, my God, allow feelings? Are you kidding? It'll never stop. But the truth of the matter is that if you allow your feelings without letting the story get in the way, without allowing the mind to jump in, you can release the emotion in 2 minutes or less.
Which is, I'm sure that takes people by surprise that that they can actually experience that kind of a release in such a short time.
I've done it again and again with my clients. You know, they'll feel bad and I'll say, okay, so let's go in. Let's check out what's going on with you. And I lead them in and they start to cry. I mean, sometimes it's not even 30 seconds and then it's done. It's done. They're like feeling better. How do you feel? Oh, I feel much better. Just allowing the feelings. We exhaust ourselves by trying to tamp those feelings down.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. So true. When you talk about helping your clients get to a point of thriving after a loss, and so I was hoping you'd describe a little bit more about that, how you help people actually thrive.
Well, remember I said before that all griefs are connected, that anything that you haven't dealt with before, it will likely pop up during your current grief. I mean, that it will be reminded. Now, it might not right away, but it could easily be accessed. So the cool and really interesting thing about a significant loss is it's an opportunity to clean house, to get rid of all the old stuff that's been holding us back for so long because we've been fighting against it. Really awesome opportunity. And it's an opportunity to learn how to listen to ourselves. It's an opportunity to become more authentic and more truly who we are. And the other thing that's really neat about it is that by delving in and looking at the way in which we react to a particular loss, we can learn so much about ourselves and about why we're here and what we're meant to do.
I love that. That's beautiful. I love that idea, Michelle, that we can use our current losses to actually help us heal something from the past, and that eventually we can be even better than we were before. We can even move to a new place and achieve a new level of insight into ourselves and a new level of freedom in a way from some of the old wounds and old pain that we've been carrying around with us for years. So I love that you help your clients do that.
Well, that is what sets me apart. Most grief groups are about helping people get through, and they use the format of the grief group where everybody sits around and tells the stories, their stories. And the problem with that, I mean, the connection is really valuable because one of the things that people need when they lose a significant person in their lives is new connections, new people that can hold a space for them, that's essential to the body. That is, by the way, one of the reasons why the body experiences a loss in the way in which it does, which is literally a threat to its survival, is that, and now I'm going afield, but I will get back, I hope. It's a threat to its survival because we are social organisms. We survive better in groups. And so we are actually wired to bond with other people. And there are chemicals that are involved in that. One of them is oxytocin, which is this really great feel-good hormone that crops up every time we gaze into somebody's eyes or we nurse a baby or we hug somebody, that we actually get an infusion of this feel good. And when you lose somebody like that, then you lose, in addition to getting all that those stress hormones, you're also losing your connection to the oxytocin. So there's an urge, this urge to bond with other people. So the grief group provides that. But one of the bad parts of it is that people sit around and tell their stories over and over and over again. And by telling the stories, each time they tell a story, if you don't do anything with that story, if you don't change the story, you actually are re-stimulating the release of the stress hormones. Because the body doesn't know the difference between our recall of the event and the actual event. It will respond the same way. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. So in a way, we're just re-traumatizing ourselves every single time. Yeah.
So my approach is to look at grief as an opportunity. Let's change the story around grief. Grief and loss are a natural part of the life experience. And it is an opportunity for us to get in touch with our bodies, with ourselves, with what's going on. It's an opportunity to look deep inside because we don't have a choice, because it's in our face. And for the first time, we can't just tamp the emotions down. That's what I found when I dealt with the loss of my parents, is I could not tamp the emotions down, which is what I did all throughout my life up until that point in time. And I was very successful at it. I was really good at compartmentalizing and putting it aside. So this is an opportunity to do a deep exploration because you have the motivation. Because normally we don't want to do that. It's a lot of work. It's painful. It's not fun. You know, it can be, but it's also, you know, it's like you go into those scary realms. And so the grief, the emotions of grief provide the fuel, the motivation for moving forward.
That's really beautiful. And it was reminding me, I've talked about this before in this interview series, that after my father died, I had the experience of getting stuck in my grief because I wanted to go back to feeling how things were before he died. And in my head, every day I would wake up and think, someday I'll feel just like I did before, and then I'll know I'm better. Someday I'll go back to that place. Everything will be like it was before he died, and I'll be fine. But that was this completely wrong thinking about the process of grief. And what I was doing was resisting changing, resisting the fact that, no, everything in my life had changed. My dad was gone. Everything had changed, and I needed to allow myself to grow through that change and allow everything to be different in my life instead of trying to hold on to the past and trying to keep the past alive. So I don't know if you see that with other people that you work with also.
Well, the interesting thing is that you can take the state of contentment that you had with your father and bring it into your present and your future. We think that by losing the person, we have lost that experience of joy. And that's the mistake. So part of my process is helping people to regain those states of joyousness and to tease them out, separate them from the association with, oh, I can never have it again because that person's dead. It's not true. So you can actually have that in your life. You can actually have that state, but you have to learn how to bring it into your present and your future. And there's some actual, what is it, NLP, neuro-linguistic programming strategies that I use with my clients to help them do that.
And so I could get back to that same state of joy and peace, but it would be a different than in the past because my father wouldn't be physically present and physically part of that,
right.
Scenario anymore.
We connect and we attach the experience to the person when the experience is always available to us. Love is always available to us. When we lose our mother, it doesn't mean the end of all love. But we associate it with that person. You know, just in the way that, you know, Pavlov's dogs associated food with the bell, we associate it. And then when that person is gone, we think that we've lost the good experience as well. And that's not necessarily true. However, that doesn't mean that you don't go through the grief in the mourning process, because that's also part of the journey. You can't short circuit it. You can't just leapfrog over it. There's work that has to be done. You have to face it.
Mm-hmm. Which I think we live in such a hurry up, fast paced society. It seems like that is our default tendency, is to try to skip over things as quickly as possible, get through it as fast as possible, move on to something else. And that's probably one of the obstacles we have with our grief as well, is that we have to learn how to slow down a little bit and actually experience it and be present with it.
Yes, that is totally true. And part of that, which is also the hurry up, is that grief is painful, that it's uncomfortable. And we also are a society that does not like to stay in a place of discomfort. Mm-hmm. And And so we want to jump out of it as soon as we can rather than be curious and say, okay, what's going on here? And the thing that's, again, is the advantage of a significant loss is you can't do it. And finally, you have to let go of that urge to run away from it. You just have to, you can't get away with it, from it. It's there and it's not going to go away.
That's true. You really are backed in, backed up against the wall. And finally, at this point, with this situation, there is nothing else you can do except address it and deal with it. You're right about that. Do you have any additional tips right now for people in the audience if they're currently dealing with grief and loss? I know you've talked, for one thing, about just feeling emotions and getting in touch with emotions. Any other suggestions that you might have?
Well, I have three principal tips that I share in my talks that I give. So the second one is to savor support. Remember, I had said that people who have lost a significant other are actually in bonding deficit. They have lost somebody that, and so it's activated that fight, flight, flee response in the organism. We need to bond to other people. And what we're often taught in our childhood is to conceal or hide our grief. That's what our parents do, and so we think, oh my God, it's shameful. And people will treat us as though it's shameful for us to grieve. And so we feel like we can't go out in public. We need to hide. We need to grieve in. But that only exacerbates it. That only makes it worse because now we are cutting ourselves off from exactly what we need. So we need to reach out to people. And those of you who aren't in grief, you need to reach out to people who are in grief. But I use the term savor support because one of the things that people who are in grief do is that they swamp the people that they reach out to. They want to tell the story over and over and over and over again. And of course, our well-meaning friends, they want to make us feel better, so they try and solve. And it creates this tension. And eventually, you can burn your support system out because you want, in a way, you want, please save me from this. Well, they can't. And so what I recommend to people who are dealing with grief and loss is to limit the time that they talk to people. You know, it's like, I just need you to hear me for 10 minutes. Can you just listen to me? You don't have to cure anything. Just listen to me. And then in addition, I encourage people to just talk about their feelings. Don't tell a story over again. People don't need the endless details of, you know, when the doctor brought out this particular shot and did this and that. They just, and for you, it's actually better to just allow the feelings. Just say, this is how I feel. So that's really important. Savor the support. Really allow yourself to take it in. I had this one client who had lost her daughter, adult daughter, and her daughter was like her best friend. And I said, try to imagine when you're receiving hugs from your well, and she had lots of relatives and family. I said, try and imagine that your daughter is hugging through them to you. And she had a hard time with that, but that's what I would recommend, is allow the hug in, because the body is happy to allow that hug in. The body wants those hugs.
I love that idea. That's very sweet. And just allowing the love to flow through other people to you, the love that you feel you're missing from your loved one, let it come to you through others.
Yeah. And then, you know, some people, I have a very open view of what happens when we die. So if somebody says that they've had been in communication with their loved one on the other side, I say, yeah, great. Here's a book that'll tell you how to do more of that. You know, allow that person who's deceased to be part of your future in a different way. They're no longer embodied, but how can you allow them in? And, you know, by making a film, my parents live on and on and on. Every time I show my film, there they are.
Yeah, so true. Yeah, and we can do that with our photographs and our yes. memorabilia. Yeah, like after my mom died, my mom's favorite color was orange, which I never really cared for myself, but my daughter gave me an orange scarf and an orange candle. And so I have some things that are orange, and they totally represent my mom to me. Every time I light the candle, every time I put on that scarf, it's my mom. She's with me.
Yeah, so yeah. Then you can invoke, and then if you can attach to that moment the experience of the love of that person as opposed to the experience of the loss of that person, then it becomes an uplifting instead of a depressing experience. And that's part of what I teach my clients, is how to shift their perception of the experience. It's really how we interpret the experience that makes the difference between whether we're up or down.
We're about out of time, Michelle. Is there any last comment you have, or any last message you'd like to leave everyone with?
Yeah, I can say one last thing, and that is to be curious. Mm. Whatever you're working on, whether it's helping somebody to pass, or it's facing your own death, or it's facing the loss of a loved one, is to be curious. It's the curiosity of, oh, that's interesting, that helps to get us through it all.
Mm. Beautiful. That's a beautiful thought to end our conversation with, to remind everyone to stay curious up through all of life about everything that's happening in life. See how fascinating and mysterious this world really is. And so I love that idea. Michelle, thank you. This has really been a beautiful discussion and so full of information for everyone. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Karen, for inviting me.
Well, I hope you found that conversation with Michelle Petacolis helpful to you, talking first of all about her film series, which you can obtain at secretsoflifeanddeath.com if you're interested. But in addition, talking about some of the physical consequences of grief, which I found very interesting, the fact that grief triggers and both an emotional and a physical response, and we can actually get physically ill from not dealing with our grief, that people who are grieving are 21 times more likely to experience a heart attack from grief. Also, she mentioned the idea that our brains experience a disturbance at the time of grief because we have certain pathways formed in our brain that include the presence of another person. And when that person is suddenly absent, there's confusion that besets the brain as it tries to rewire itself literally to include a new reality in which the physical presence of the person who has died is no longer there and available. And so that was very interesting. We talked a little bit about the fact that when people experiencing grief approach someone in the medical system for help, they're very often diagnosed as suffering with depression and given medication. But sometimes what they really need is other treatment. And Michelle mentioned too that one of the things she doesn't really like support groups, traditional grief support groups, because sometimes they encourage telling the story over and over again. And telling the story actually re-triggers the stress hormones in the body, re-traumatizing the person who has experienced grief. She talks as well about the need for oxytocin, which is the hormone that bonds us to others, and how there's a disruption in the oxytocin when someone close to us has died, and that we really need to restore in a physical way through hugging or touching with other people, restore some of that oxytocin in order to find our way back to health and back to thriving. And she mentioned three things. I wrote down three tips she had. The first is to allow our feelings of grief rather than trying to run away from them, trying to correct them, trying to get rid of them. Just allow the feelings to be there and get in touch with our body and what our body is telling us about our emotions of grief. Her next tip was to savor the support around us. And she talked about the fact that we can sometimes experience fatigue in our supporters if we talk too much about the loss and tell the story too often, rather than talking just about our feelings and letting our support person be there to help us with our feelings. So once again, she's emphasizing it's the emotion and the feelings that really matter in this process of dealing with our grief. So we need to begin by allowing the feelings to be present. And when we do talk with others and seek support from others, being able to express our feelings to those people instead of simply going back and reliving the story, which as we mentioned before, can be traumatic, like in a support group when we tell the story over and over and cause another release of the stress hormones that we're already dealing with. And then lastly, she mentioned shifting our perception of loss into the idea that we have, when another person dies, we have lost the physical experience of that person, but we have not lost love, and that we can still recall love and experience love and joy, even though the person who has died is not physically present with us, and that when we do go into a state of love and joy, we're more likely to be able to connect with the person who has died and feel closer to that person after death. So those tips I found really helpful and really useful. I hope they're useful to you as well. Be sure to tune in every Monday for a new episode of the podcast. And until next week, remember to face your fear, be ready for whatever life brings your way, and love your life. Love every moment of it. See you next week. Until then, take care. Bye-bye.